I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today will be with a reporter who helped uncover the president's warrantless wiretapping program. But first, let's check in Pennsylvania. Ahead of tomorrow's primary, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama spent the weekend sharpening their attack knives. Clinton pounced on Obama yesterday for saying Republican John McCain would be better than President Bush, and she unleashed this ad.
The difference between talk and action?
I don't take money from oil companies or Washington lobbyists.
But in the last 10 years, Barack Obama has taken almost $2 million from lobbyists, corporations, and PACs. The head of his New Hampshire campaign...
Obama responded that a desperate Clinton was throwing the kitchen sink and even the china at him and came out with a counterattack ad of his own, saying he doesn't take one dime of special interest money, but she does. Well, what is clear is that Obama is outspending Clinton 2-1 in Pennsylvania, state where she once had a commanding lead. Joining us on the line, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for the New York Times. He's actually at an Obama campaign event. John, you write today that more than any recent White House race, this campaign boils down to delegates, dollars, votes, and polls. And a new metric, this victory margin, what is that?
Well, look, Robin, Hillary Clinton is favored to win in Pennsylvania. The demographics of this state, which have been very powerful in every state throughout the campaign, are favorable to lots of older voters, lots of blue-collar white voters, which are good targets for her. That's why she is favored to win, and she's held a lead consistently. She has to change the dynamic of the race, and the way to do that in her favor is to win big. If you talk to both campaigns, they concede that she is likely to win the race. She's hoping to exceed that 10 percentage point margin that she had in the state of Ohio. If she loses, she's probably knocked out of the race. The late polls tell us, Robin, that looks like a more middling outcome, a single-digit victory for her, which is probably going to be enough for her to keep going.
Well, let's remind ourselves, Barack Obama has won more states, more votes, has raised more money, and won over more delegates. So you say single digits, she could go on, but how low could those single digits go and perhaps change that?
The Obama campaign tells me that with optimum turnout performance, they could get within a couple of points of Hillary Clinton. The Clinton campaign, I just got off a conference call with them. They say that's lowballing. Obama's really trying to win and knock her out of the race. But it appears that this is one of those states like Ohio before that is just a very heavy lift for Barack Obama. And so we have both sides throwing the kitchen sink at one another toward the end. Barack Obama's got a lot more money, and we'll see how it comes out.
And what, by the way, does the Clinton campaign have to do to turn this around? There's still talk that they will look for the Florida votes and the Michigan votes, but at a certain point there's a math problem.
Oh, the math problem is getting very severe, and they acknowledge it. They have to fundamentally change the dynamic of this race and all of a sudden make the rest of the party wake up and say, wait a minute, Barack Obama's not as strong as we thought. He can't win a general election. And they have to get on a roll and beat him in these primaries. So that's why if she wins the way the polls are suggesting right now, 5, 6, 7 points, people will sort of yawn at that, and then we'll go on to Indiana and North Carolina on May the 6th, and she's still going to be waiting for that event that causes everybody to look at this race in a new way. Because if they look at it the old way, she's on track to lose.
And we're reminded that in past campaigns, it could be a helmet and a tank. It could be anything that could shift the energy of a campaign.
Well, and that's what the Clinton campaign was hoping out of so-called Bittergate, you know, those remarks that Obama made at that closed-door San Francisco fundraiser out of the debate last week when he was on the defensive over Jeremiah Wright and his association with someone in Chicago who once was a member of the Weather Underground. None of those things so far look like they've changed in any fundamental way the attitudes of superdelegates who are slowly trickling in Obama's direction or the voters. We have not seen a big shift in national polls.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for the New York Times in Pennsylvania, ahead of tomorrow's important primary. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We now know about the Bush administration's once super-secret warrantless wiretapping program. But did you know that John Ashcroft's wife stuck her tongue out at then-White House aides Alberto Gonzalez and Andy Card as they walked out of her husband's hospital room in that late-night attempt to get Ashcroft to renew President Bush's wiretapping program? She stuck her tongue out. It's one of the hundreds of details in reporter Eric Lischblau's new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Eric and his colleague at the New York Times, James Risen, broke the warrantless wiretapping story. They would win the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting. Eric's new book is a relentless timeline of the Bush administration's now very public pledge to remake the American justice system to fight their declared war on terrorism, or as critics would say, use that war to mask a move to remake justice. Today, a conversation with Eric Lischblau. He joins us in the studios. Eric, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's quite a read. It's all here. The secret CIA monitoring of bank statements, the FBI's secret files on peaceful war protesters, the Geneva Conventions being declared quaint by Alberto Gonzalez. It's kind of overwhelming, actually. I mean, when you look at cover to cover, your thoughts on it?
Well, it's been a remarkable 6 or 7 years that we lived through. I mean, since 9/11, I think this will be looked back on as a historic time in American history. The aftermath of 9/11 and the tensions that we're now seeing between kind of the old ways and the new are something that, you know, historians are going to look back on 50 and 100 years from now and say, wow, that was quite a period.
And Americans are already viewing it. It's sort of right now, it's like the elephant analogy. They have their hand on one part of it,
right?
You know, and viewing it, you know, in different ways as well. I want to talk about that. But let's start with that story that you were so deeply involved with, the warrantless wiretapping.
Sure.
This was the administration's end run around the special FISA courts that were set up in the 70s and required a warrant for any espionage involving Americans here in the U.S. Your paper knew about the warrantless wiretapping program early on and didn't write about it. So first, how early on? Give us a little timeline. And why didn't you write about it?
Well, my partner at the paper, Jim Risen, and I started hearing separately, actually, about this mystery intelligence program it was early in 2004, the spring of 2004, and we're pulling at different strands of this. We didn't realize that we were pulling at different strands of the same ball of yarn, as it were.
And but, we should say that you heard about it because there were people saying, you should check something out. There were people in the administration who were worried about it.
There was a lot of nervousness within the administration. We didn't realize until much later that this was coinciding with what would turn out to be now a famous revolt over, if you remember, the scene of John Ashcroft's hospital bedside. Basically, within the government, within the executive branch, there was near bedlam over this program, and we were just seeing the very faintest kind of tremors from that. We started reporting it. We started writing up some drafts based on what we were able to cobble together.
I should say, when you say reporting it, you started further investigating and learning and writing, as you said, drafts.
We did, and pretty soon we had a good enough sense to understand the basic parameters of what this story was, that there had been a program approved at the highest levels by Bush himself, it seemed, that allowed the National Security Agency to do something that it had not been allowed to do before, which was to wiretap Americans, their international communications, without a court order. This was a radical shift in the way intelligence had been gathered in the past and was a huge story.
And in fact, the FISA courts have been set up in part because Richard Nixon was caught spying on Americans.
Right. There was a law created in 1978 after Watergate as a result of the abuses of Nixon and earlier abuses that specifically set up a court as basically a safeguard against abuses by the executive branch. If you wanted to wiretap on Americans, you went through this court.
So here you've got this bombshell,
right,
and you don't write it.
Right. What happened was that, as we would do with any story, sensitive or not sensitive, we went to the people involved. In this case, that was the administration, to say, hey, we're looking at this story. And we got a big red light from the administration, basically urging the Times editors at levels much higher than mine not to run this story.
Because?
They said that to publicize the existence of this program would do irreparable harm to national security and would essentially cost Americans' lives.
People would die, they said.
People would die, yes. That this was a program that was saving Americans' lives every day that it existed, and to out the program would make it useless. You got to remember the time period we're in. We're only a couple years out of 9/11 at that point. It was a different mindset in a lot of ways. When When you have top officials at the White House making claims like that, any editor is going to listen two and three times, listen very hard and very carefully to a claim like that, and the editors did. And the first go-round on that, which was in late 2004, in the fall of 2004, the editors ultimately decided that this was not a story they were comfortable running.
Well, and a year later, fall of 2005, Jim Risen tells the editors, look, I'm gonna include this in a book I'm writing, you know, so... What do you think of that? And, you know, added a little pressure to them to reconsider putting it in the paper. Now it gets very serious, this sort of headbutting between the Times and the White House.
Right. After Jim was considering putting in his book, which was certainly a trigger for all this, the editors looked back on the decision that they had made a year earlier. This led to a whole other round of discussions with the White House. You know, this time around, some things had changed. We already knew about some of the legal reservations among some officials within the administration about this program. Was this legal? Was the president claiming authority that he didn't really have? Those concerns became even more apparent to us as we went back and did more reporting.
Well, the other thing that was happening over the, you know, the course of the year, when you decided not to run it and when the discussion started again, is that during that year, you're aware of this program and you're watching President Bush push for the Patriot Act and saying what about wiretapping and spying on Americans?
Well, several times during the course of that, the president made the assertion that, hey, whenever you hear about wiretaps, hey, remember, that requires a court order. A judge is involved. And this was part of the push for the Patriot Act reauthorization, which was a very, very big issue for the administration in 2004, was that there are the necessary checks and balances. You know, you can rest easy because all the oversight and safeguards are in place.
So how are you and other New York Times reporters or editors who knew about the warrantless wiretapping program? How are you?
Well, there were many of us, yeah. But among, well, for me personally, I was covering a lot of that Patriot Act stuff, and I got to admit it was difficult. You know, covering those issues day in, day out, while knowing about what seemed like the 800-pound gorilla in the room, what was frustrating at times.
And Alberto Gonzalez was also giving testimony in Congress during this time and being asked about the possibility of warrantless wiretapping.
Right. There was one scene that I relate in the book where Senator Russ Feingold danced right up to the edge of this issue and asked Gonzalez whether it was possible for the president, claiming the broad presidential mandate that he had, to, for instance, to order wiretapping on Americans without a warrant. And Gonzalez danced around the issue and said he wouldn't be discussing theoreticals. Well, as I knew sitting there, and as we would later learn, these were not theoreticals. This was a very real issue and very live at that moment.
The paper ultimately prints the story. You're excoriated by many Americans who felt that you were giving away some of the country's secrets. But on the other hand, people on the left said to you, if you had run that story a year ago, that was the fall of 2004. That was just weeks before the election, and perhaps it might have changed the outcome of that election.
We got beat up by everyone, the folks on the left, the folks on the right, the folks in the middle. This was such a sensitive story that as one of my editors warned me at the time, everyone was going to have a very fierce reaction to it, and that was certainly true.
Eric Lischblau, his new book is Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. It's filled with people wrongly detained under the Bush surveillance programs. For instance, the Iranian-American nephrologist in Kentucky, suspected of helping Osama bin Laden with his kidneys. We'll be back with more from Eric later. What a race for the women, a report from the Boston Marathon finish line. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Eric Lischblau of The New York Times. His new book is Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. It's filled with fascinating details and characters, both inside and outside the government, all caught up in different ways in a dragnet to prevent another terrorist attack. Eric, you start with a story of a Detroit prosecutor and an FBI agent crawling all over a roof in Turkey. They thought they were onto what?
This was just months after 9/11, and it's a remarkable scene, I think, in which you have an FBI agent and a U.S. prosecutor with a sketch in hand that they had found in a Detroit apartment, and they're convinced that this is a sketch of the next big attack on a U.S. airbase in Turkey. If you're in the moment, if you're there on the roof, right. it shows the urgent attempt and the understandable attempt right. to do everything in their power to stop the next 9/11, to do things that would have been unthinkable just months before 9/11, where you here you literally have assistant prosecutors and FBI agents climbing up the walls of Turkish rooftops with doodlings in their hand. This was a case that the President Bush himself and then Attorney General Ashcroft pointed to as having stopped a big terrorist attack in Detroit, and very soon it collapsed in court. They got convictions of these four men based in part on this sketch, but then the government basically turned on itself. You had agents turning on agents, prosecutors turning on prosecutors, and the government was forced to admit that the sketch they were looking at might have just been the doodling of a mentally deranged man, that maybe they were just looking at etchings of a Middle Eastern map. To me, it was an example of the old system clashing with a new. The dangers potentially of overreaching. You even had the prosecutor in this case, the man up on the rooftop, who was accused and indicted on perjury charges. He was later acquitted. It sort of showed all the potential pitfalls of these new policies.
You could read this book and you could say, oh my gosh, look at this overreaching on the part of the Bush administration. Or you could read the book and you can say, yeah, pictures of crop dusters. Wow, I'm glad they checked that guy out in right. Kentucky. You say at different points in the book that there was outrage when the public learned about some of these programs. Was there really? Is there really? Because aren't most of them still in place?
Well, most of these programs are still in place. I mean, they've been scaled back to some extent. I think what we've seen the last few years is recalculation of the checks and balances, if you will, that most of these programs remain secret through 2004, 2005. Now it's only through the media, through public reporting on things like Guantanamo and interrogation practices and waterboarding and renditions and NSA surveillance, and the list goes on and on, that there has been public scrutiny, and the Congress has been drawn back into these things. The courts have been drawn back into them, and there has been a scaling back of a lot of these programs. The administration has been forced to retreat on some of the more far-reaching programs.
Well, and where do you think it's going to go? I mean, if there is, for instance, a Democratic president, is that person going to be willing to take the risk of dismantling these programs and perhaps have an attack on the U.S. follow?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, all three of the candidates have, to varying degrees, pledged to restore checks and balances, as they like to say. Obama has certainly been the most aggressive about that, but McCain, on certain issues, has made similar pledges. But, you know, does the rhetoric match the reality? Once you're the one in the Oval Office, clearly your first mandate is going to be stopping an attack on your watch. No one is going to want that. And once you've been handed these cool new tools in the tool chest by your predecessor, I'm not sure that any president is going to give those away willingly.
And what has been accomplished? I mean, we know about the Lackawanna Six from the Buffalo area in New York. They really had gone overseas to train for al-Qaeda before chickening out. But we just recently see a jury in Miami force a second deadlock in that Miami terrorism case. It was supposed to be exposing a homegrown terrorism cell, and the jury is not so sure about that. So I want to ask what these programs have accomplished, but they're secret, so we don't really know.
It's very difficult to assess. It's clearly been a mixed bag. The administration will point to certain successes when it comes to the NSA wiretapping program and interrogation programs. Some of those appear legitimate. Others are heavily disputed, even by, for instance, British allies. You know, talk about plots that the U.S. says were uncovered by the NSA wiretapping. And the Brits will say, no, we don't think that that's how you uncovered that. Certainly, you know, that's not to say that al-Qaeda is not a continuing threat, and there have been ongoing plots. Oftentimes, it's not quite to the extent and to the hype that's made out to be. The Miami case is a good example where that was announced, you know, to much fanfare a year or so ago, that these guys were going to take down the Chicago Sears Tower. They haven't been able to get a single conviction out of that yet.
I just want to close by reinforcing something we said at the beginning. The reason that you know as much as you know, enough to write this very dense and full telling of the story, is that the debate goes on within the Bush administration. I'm thinking of Jim Ziegler, who was the head of the Immigration Services. It seemed almost on day one, 9/11, said, wait a minute, we have this thing called the Constitution.
Right, right. Yeah, I found that kind of a fascinating starting point in the whole debate, that literally on the day of 9/11, top intelligence officials and law enforcement officials were gathered at the FBI's emergency headquarters to figure out, what do we do now? How do we stop the next attack? And there was, you know, outright fear and outrage in the room. And there was talk of door-to-door questioning, perhaps roundups in heavily Muslim neighborhoods. And you had a guy like Jim Ziegler, who was the head of the INS at that time, saying, wait a second, what are we talking about here? That what you're talking about is something like the British monarch was doing in colonial America. And he refused to take part. He said the INS is not going to be a part of this. And you saw that tension. You know, I don't try and say who's right and who's wrong, but it's this really historic clash between different forces on the same side. I mean, someone like Jim Ziegler was a Barry Goldwater conservative. This is a Republican through and through. And a lot of the folks who we're talking about who ultimately raised questions about the NSA wiretapping, these are through and through Republicans who believe in a strong executive power, people like Jim Comey and Jack Goldsmith on the NSA wiretapping program. These are not people who can be pigeonholed as soft on terrorism. You had divisions, you had real legal tensions between people who were essentially on the same side of the question. And I found that a fascinating story to try and tell.
And Eric Lischblau tells that story in Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. He also, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter of the New York Times. Eric, thanks so much for coming to tell us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, and tomorrow on Here and Now, an update on the story of a Mali midwife impacting lives even after her own death in childbirth. And still ahead today, sticker shock at the supermarket, farmers saying it's about time. Here and Now. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling for more global food production after riots in Haiti, Egypt, and Bangladesh, prompted by a 40% spike in global food prices. We want to take a look at food prices. They're up in large part because the demand is greater than the supply, but it's also more expensive to produce food. Listen to these two farmers at the Ridge Restaurant in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Their production costs are skyrocketing because of the price of oil.
Well, anything that's produced with oil, our fertilizers and chemicals that we need to produce the crops.
You know, there's a lot of debate about this. A lot of Americans say, well, why should grain prices stay up, especially if, you know, some people think they're artificially inflated, they're subsidized by the government, because then all our food costs so much more with corn syrup and stuff poured into it.
Why shouldn't it cost more? Why shouldn't it cost more? I mean, you stop to look. The prices have never increased with the rate of inflation, and American people got used to cheap food prices, and now that it's went up, they're crying.
Well, for more, we turn to Mike Santoli, associate editor at Barron's Magazine. Mike, a common refrain, they say it's about time people paid more for their food.
Well, it's understandable they would feel that way. And what I think the main takeaway from that kind of sentiment among farmers is that that is going to impede them from being interested in plowing more land. In other words, increasing the amount of land devoted to producing more and therefore increasing the supply, which would later bring down food prices. So I think that's the difficulty we have right now, is that demand keeps rising largely because of increasing demand from fast developing countries overseas, China, India, Latin America, other parts of Asia, and the supply is not really keeping pace. Therefore, higher prices result, and we are really plowing far fewer acres in this country than we have several years back. That long period of depressed crop prices caused farmers to leave the business, and we plow them over and pave them over with subdivisions and things like that. So this is the fix that we're in, that we cannot rapidly increase the supply of food at a time when demand looks like it's going to be stubbornly moving higher.
Sure. These farmers said just that. You know, if you go out there to Pennsylvania, the landscape is dotted with these new developments, and the farmers say, hey, how can you blame us? Why should I invest, you know, $50,000 in, you know, plow it into the ground and fertilizer and seeds and machinery? And it's a gamble if I can't pay it off. So why not sell the land and get some money and build a development and I'm out of here?
Yeah, and that is definitely the dynamic that's been in force to date. Now, markets work this way. When people get used to the idea that prices are going to keep going higher, they will reverse themselves and say, you know what, I'm going to get into this farm business. In fact, we at Barron's have written something about the boom in farm real estate prices. So this is happening slowly. You're seeing these investment syndicates even go out to parts of the Midwest, buy up land. land and essentially treat it as an investment because they do believe it's worth betting for the longer term that crop prices are going to be higher. But this process doesn't happen rapidly, as we all know. It's not just a matter of waiting for the season's harvest. It's a matter of, you know, taking years to have the land conditioned and all the rest. So obviously, it's a global market for all crops, for all food, and other places in the world are able to increase more. Places like Brazil, for example, Russia's still a major producer of many crops. So it's not so much, you know, strictly tied to what we're doing here, but it doesn't help that there's this resistance to this point to increase the supply.
Let's get to some of the problems that they're speaking of. They mentioned the increase in the price of fertilizer. We understand this is one of the biggest cost increases, tripling in some cases. Why is that?
Well, natural gas is one of the most important inputs in terms of producing fertilizer. Natural gas prices have been pulled upward because of increased demand and also because the crude oil prices, they kind of track crude oil prices to some degree. And obviously, you know, crude has nearly quadrupled in price in the last 5 years, both because of the supply demand as well as, you know, geopolitical concerns about, you know, the volatile areas where we get our oil from. So that, to me, is the big driver of fertilizer. Plus, we do have this issue of ethanol. It's diverting a lot of food resources into the gas tanks of cars. And, you know, it is really an artificial influence, because if it made a ton of economic sense to, you know, use corn for ethanol, then it would have happened on its own. It wouldn't have required a law encouraging a certain amount of ethanol production. I do think that's a bit of a distortive picture. And what happened there is farmers switched to corn if their land was devoted to something else, because they wanted to take advantage of the ethanol bounty, and therefore fewer soybeans being planted, less wheat being planted, the prices of those things go up. So it's all related.
When critics of ethanol say it's not even energy efficient, you know, you're switching from oil to something that it costs so much energy just to produce the ethanol. Well, there's also, as you alluded to, shortages caused by countries getting developed, becoming wealthier, and demanding more. China and India, for instance.
Exactly. And in fact, it's one of the most ironclad dynamics in economics, that as a population has higher incomes, they get richer, they move into the middle class, their diets improve. It's one of the first effects of essentially a growing middle class. And one form that takes, the predominant form that takes, is more protein, less starch staples. What happens with protein is if you're going to be eating more meat, it takes a lot more in the way of feed to produce, you know, an ounce or a pound of meat than it would if you just ate the crop, the grain in the first place. So it does create this effect of exacerbating the swings, and it's something that I don't really think many people see changing very soon. Obviously, on a short-term basis, if meat prices get out of reach of populations in certain areas, then they're going to slow their increased consumption of them. But that is one of the major demand forces out there in the world.
Do you think that this is going to be the way of life? I mean, people in other parts of the world say to Americans, hey, we've been paying more for our food, for our fuel in Europe for a while. You need to get used to it.
Well, in a way, what's happening here is for more than 30 years in this country, U.S. consumers have had the amount of their income that was required to pay to put food on the table has been going nothing but down. Those farmers are correct in that sense. It used to be one of the major expenses of any household. It's still obviously a major expense, but it's been going down as a proportion of income. So what you're seeing now is it's kind of rebounding a little bit as a proportion of what we spend and a proportion of what we earn. Do I think it's a permanent situation? No. But it could be here for a while. The thing about commodity prices is they self-correct. The solution for high oil prices ultimately is high oil prices, because it will reduce demand at some price.
Because if you raise the cost of a gallon of gas, people will drive less.
They will drive less, or they can't afford it. Yeah. We've seen very, very tentative signs that when gasoline gets to $4, the consumption does flatten out or go down a touch. So, you know, at some, you never know the price in advance that's going to cause that. But it does seem as if, at some level it'll happen. Now, the problem with oil is that it's really not so easy to decide to make more of it. That's not really the case with food. I mean, we ultimately can cultivate more. Ultimately, technology does create higher yields on crops. But I do think for some number of years, we might have to deal with this sort of sticker shock effect at the grocery store.
Mike Santoli, associate editor at Barron's Magazine. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And by the way, are you reacting to higher food prices? Are you buying less or maybe growing your own? We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. Still to come, the Boston Marathon, the women neck and neck down the home stretch. You're listening to Here and Now. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One if by land, two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm." Of course, some of Longfellow's account of the midnight ride of Paul Revere, a story that's reenacted every year here in Boston today on what we call Patriots Day. But what are we missing in the retelling? David Hackett Fisher is author of Paul Revere's Ride. He also teaches history at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mr. Fisher, Paul Revere was on the opposite shore of Cambridge watching for that signal light, but he never said the British are coming. He said the regulars are coming.
He said the regulars are out.
The regulars are out. Well, let's back up. Paul Revere and William Dawes rode to Lexington to alert John Hancock and Samuel Adams that the regulars were out. They rode separately in case one was captured. But Paul Revere is in his 30s. He wasn't classically educated. Why was he a participant in the first place?
Well, he was a man who everybody knew. He belonged to lots of different groups in this very small town of Boston. It wasn't just one revolutionary movement. And only two people belonged to nearly all of them. One of them was Dr. Joseph Warren, with whom he worked, and the other was Paul Revere.
He was an activist.
You could say so. What he did was to create a network of people. It's possible now to go down to the Massachusetts Historical Society and to, with one touch of an enter key, one can find all the diaries that were kept on that day, April 18th, April 19th. Amongst other things, they told us how people got the word. And we were able to identify something like 60 people who were out riding that night, all of the messengers carrying this news.
Because Paul Revere, after he left Lexington, was captured by the British before he got to Concord. So the fact that he had set up this network was actually what got the message out.
That's correct. And we learn, by the numbers, the numbers keep growing. We're now up to 80 altogether.
Huh.
The more we know about these people, the more important he becomes. Paul Revere and Dr. Warren organized this web of communication. These were cantankerous Yankees all, and the job was to get them all working together, and that's what they were about. They were also much concerned about intelligence, and so after General Gage's first preemptive strikes.
General Gage being, of course, the British...
He was the governor of Massachusetts and the commander-in-chief of British forces in America. When General Gage made his first preemptive strike on the Powder House in what is now Medford, Somerville, Massachusetts, on the line, and what he did was to succeed in a tactical way. He got the gunpowder away, but the people of New England were outraged, infuriated by what had happened. And they picked up their weapons and marched on Boston. And the Whig leaders, that is, the leaders of the revolutionary movement, were much pressed to keep a war from happening.
Right, because they wanted the other side to fire the first shot.
Exactly. And to be sure that they could control these events and not be surprised again, Paul Revere organized what I think we could call the first American intelligence service. These were mechanics in Boston who patrolled the streets, kept an eye on General Gage, had agents in General Gage's quarters, and they were not surprised again.
Oh. That's David Hackett Fisher. He's author of Paul Revere's Ride. He also teaches history at Brandeis University here in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mr. Fisher, I wish you a happy Patriots Day. I know this is a big day for you and other historians.
Happy Patriots Day to you.
Thank you. And we're going to leave you with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's performance of Paul Revere's Ride by composers David Del Tredici and Christopher Theofanides.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear. disappear on the midnight ride. The poll review on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day, and you who remembers that famous day, and you.
Well, today, Paul Revere reenactors heading west from Boston past runners coming back the other way. We'll check in at the finish line of the Boston Marathon here and now.
If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight,
one runner in the field of more than 25,000 in today's Boston Marathon is the man who won the race 40 years ago. Ambie Burfoot is running with several of his friends today, including some who ran with him back in 1968. At that time, he was a 20-year-old senior at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He'd been training obsessively for 5 years with one goal in mind, winning Boston, the oldest marathon in the world. Today, Burfoot is 61 years old. He's editor-at-large for Runner's World magazine, and he writes about his 1968 win in the May issue. Last week, while workers were setting up the marathon's finish line in downtown Boston, Ambie Burfoot spoke there with Here Now's Alex Ashlock.
You come back every year to this spot. You started running this race in the mid-60s, I believe. Obviously, you won it in 1968. How does it feel to come back every year?
It feels better and better every year to come back to Boston because each year with the passage of time, I think you're more appreciative of everything in your life and particularly in my case of the fact that 40 years later, I think I can still get from Hopkinton to downtown Boston on foot, and I'm hoping so.
You write about the 1968 race in Runner's World magazine, and you were terrified that even though you were so well trained for this race, you were going to lose it. Tell me a little bit about the race itself.
Well, what happened was in the second part of the race, two of us broke away from everyone else, myself and a good friend, a guy named Bill Clark. And he trailed me all the way knowing that he could outkick me at the end. I knew he could outkick me at the end, so I thought the race was all like for nothing, for naught, a complete waste. So I was very depressed at the thought that I was going to finish second in the Boston Marathon. Luckily for me, unluckily for Bill, he cramped on the downhills, which is very common at Boston, and I was able to sneak away from him by a few seconds.
Talk a little more about that fear you had of you being outkicked. You write about how you had led so many races and been caught from behind at the end.
I think the thing was that even though I very much wanted to win the Boston Marathon and to put myself out front and in position to win, I didn't expect to be out there for 13 or 14 miles, and felt very, very vulnerable. And particularly when there was this one guy trailing me the whole way, and it was a bright, sunny day, and his shadow was on the road in front of me, and it was almost like a specter, like a ghost haunting me the whole way. And I think it was the fear that I had come so close. I was leading Boston. I led it for 5 miles, 6, 8, 10 miles, but that it would fall away from my grasp at the last moment just had me in terror.
You ran incredible amounts of mileage, it seemed to me, preparing for the Boston Marathon. I think you were running 30 miles a day at some points.
I think it would be safe to say I was obsessed by running at that point in my life. Everyone else in college in the 60s, you know, was free love and drugs and all that stuff. And what was I doing? I was getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to run and running again in the late afternoon. And I was compelled to be everything I could be as a runner at that stage in my life. And it was a hard path and atypical then. No rewards, no money, no nothing to run the Boston Marathon. But it was a dream, and I chased my dream.
Tell me about what happened at the finish line. You won the race. The marathon clearly wasn't the event, I guess, on a large scale that it is today. What happened at the finish line when the race director, Jock Semple, met you?
They gave me a bowl of beef stew, and I was a vegetarian. No, Jock Semple caught me as I collapsed at the finish line, and I was essentially in a state of collapse. I had run myself just to the point of total exhaustion in the last 5 or 6 miles. And today, talking to you, I can still feel the warmth and the strength of his arms supporting me, something supporting me other than my own weak, tired muscles at the end, and it was just the most incredibly thrilling experience I could possibly imagine.
What did he say to you?
He said, "Ambi, you did it. You won the Boston Marathon."
40 years later, you're still running. You said you were, it's safe to say, you were obsessed with running before. What part does running play in your life today?
Well, it's a little bit more balanced, although my wife thinks I'm still obsessed by exercise. I spend a fair amount of time every morning on a recumbent bicycle in the house reading the newspapers and things like that. I love the feeling of exercise. I love the feeling of my body being in motion. I love being fit and healthy and active and energetic, which I think is the way most runners are. I have no illusions about running fast in the Boston Marathon or in any other marathon. I run a marathon a year or so now, but it's purely for the experience. It's a celebration of life. There's nothing else I can say about it. I'll be lost in the middle of the pack. The race will not make a difference to any soul on earth except to me. And to me, you know what? It'll be pretty darn important because it'll say, you know, I'm still alive and well and kicking and moving forward.
Do you think this particular race, you love it so much, but has it gotten too big?
The size of marathons doesn't bother me at all. I know some of the old-timers, like myself, do whine about that. But I feel that at a time of national health crisis and obesity and sedentary living, that the more people we can invite out to the streets of Boston and every other race and town and marathon, the better off we all are as a society. Because I think each and every one of those 25,000 runners is going to inspire another 5 or 10 or 20 to get a little bit healthier in their life, and I hope that will be the outcome.
You touched on this slightly, I think, in an earlier answer to a question, but do your memories or your appreciation of what you did 40 years ago change over time? Do you feel differently about that day? Does it become more important to you?
I don't think about the day very much at all, of course. And when I had to sit down and write the Runner's World story, I was quite surprised by the number of memories that did come back and the specificity and the arcaneness and the strangeness of some of those memories. But mainly what all of us remember at Boston is the friends we've made over the years, some of whom are no longer with us, of course, but many of whom are, and whether it's Greg Meyer and Joan Samuelson running anniversary races this year, or Bill Rogers, or all of the old great runners from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There's been a very, very special class of people that have somehow ended up being emblematic of marathoning, and especially the Boston Marathon. And I feel very, very lucky to be a part of that group.